Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in custom clothier, we can call you that.
Yeah.
Upcycler, yep. Punk rock extraordinaire, Brandy Cole from Gluehead Handmade Punk Rock Goods. Brandy, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh man, I'm so happy that you're here. So I have noticed that you've got a broad swath of creativity, and I kind of like to start at the start, but you get to tell me where that is. Can you tell me when creativity came in your life, when you started to see something as being something more, or a way you were going to make something out of nothing?
Yeah, I think when I was a kid, my dad, I grew up with my dad taking old junk cars, throwing a paint job on them, getting them running, and selling them and kind of flipping them. So in a lot of senses, that's kind of what I'm doing now with clothes and taking old junk that no one really wanted and making it something that someone sees the value in again. When I was a kid, I would say I was pretty creative, into model cars, into skateboards, and drawing, mimicking the graphics on skateboards and stuff like that. So I think that's basically where it started from.
So do you remember the first thing other than, do you remember the first piece of clothing you put together? I'm imagining the first thing you did was probably the model cars and stuff like that.
Model cars, yeah. But first piece of clothing, I remember I must have been in middle school-ish. I had an old denim jacket and went through my mom's fabric little chest thing that she had there with her sewing kit and just started pulling stuff out and just kind of trying to mimic some of the leather jackets that I saw. You know, the guys had the full, like, either hand-painted logos or they would have one sleeve that was one solid color.
So what was the inspiration for that? Where did you see that?
When I was skateboarding, or when I was a little kid, I got into skateboarding and reading Thrasher.
Classic.
So Thrasher had not only a ton of skateboarder stuff in it, but they had music reviews.
Mm.
And long before internet streaming and all that stuff, you would see these bands and you're like, I got to find out about these guys. What's their deal? Why are they look so wild, you know, compared to like even the stuff, you know, the heavy metal guys or whatever at that time that were trying to look wild. These people looked crazier in their own way. You know what I mean? It almost seemed like they were just doing whatever it is that they wanted to do, not trying to fit a mold or whatever. So I would see those interviews in the magazines, see their pictures and stuff. And then that's what really got me into, like, yeah, this is who I want to try to be. You know what I mean?
So you recognized someone carving their own niche amongst people carving their own niche.
Exactly. It wasn't good enough to be into a subculture. I had to get into a finer subculture. I've always been a nerd like that. When it comes to something, I can't just leave it at a surface level. I have to know more and more and more about it. I have to, okay, so if this band makes this music that I like, why do they make that music? Who inspired them? And now I like this person, you know, as well as this other original band that I was listening to.
Do you remember anybody who exemplified that to you, or how that came to be, or was that just kind of your default setting and you just applied it to the different spots it cropped up in?
So I didn't know it when I was a kid, but looking back on it, it became obvious. I've got OCD.
Yeah.
Like clinically diagnosed OCD. So that 100% was where I got into all this, like, digging deeper and wanting to know more.
So it was satisfying.
It was an itch that I had to scratch. Had to. It was fun for me, obviously, but it was it was a job. As a little kid, it was my job to figure out, where did this come from? How did this happen? How do you, you know, how do you make this? How do, you know? So when I was a little kid, I was into some of the weirdest stuff. Like, I would collect like paint chip books for like automotive paint. They would come out each year and right. here's the different and just study through those and look at, you know, different color combinations and, you know, different parts catalogs and all this crazy shit. It was like it was a need that I had to just discover everything there was. If I was into cars, then I needed to know what color is this? This is a blah, blah, blah. It's from an, you know, 78 Datsun or whatever it is.
Because like, a lot of those colors at that point were really big deals too.
Yeah.
Not that they aren't now.
Right. But. Yeah. It's always been, if I'm into something, I have to get into it completely.
Okay. So when you first get into your mom's fabric chest and yeah. you pull out some fabric, where does that take you initially? Cause I'm guessing you're self-taught on all of it, right?
Yes. And she's not, so my grandmother was a seamstress, it kind of skipped my mother's generation. She didn't really do a whole lot with it. She can sew.
Right.
And she kind of taught me a little bit of hand stitching. But really, that's very simple stuff. You know what I mean? We never really had a sewing machine when I grew up. So I would just hand stitch everything. And it would, you know, hold up pretty well, actually. After the first time I put the big green sleeve on this black denim jacket, I wore it around like it was the shit. You know what I mean? It was
success.
No patches other than just like, you know, I found some random plaid and I put that on the back. I may have actually had a, I stole a 7-inch Dead Kennedys record from this like record fair thing, and it came with a armband, so that went on there too,
of course,
you know. So but yeah, after that it was okay, let's figure out how to make something even cooler next time, you know. Let's figure out where do I go and get patches from, how do studs work. You know, you'd see all these, like, old videos. That's the other thing, too, at the time, as I was – we were trading tapes around. So
– missed that.
Yeah. So we had – going around the school at the time was Punk and Disorderly. Everyone had a real bad copy of Punk and Disorderly. But it was amazing because – throw it in the VCR, and you could see all these crazy bands from, you know, England.
Right.
That before streaming, before the internet, before, you know, this was like underground-ish stuff. You know what I mean? So that was really a huge inspiration, too.
Just yeah, talk to me a little bit about what it took to plug into the underground at that time, because I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand now because everything is so accessible. But, I mean, I remember ordering Marilyn Manson VHSs from South America, so yeah. I'm right there with you. Tell me a little bit about that, how that was for you as you're getting into the punk scene.
Yeah, so luckily grew up in Clearwater and had friends that their parents would drive us down to St. Pete for shows pretty early on.
Nice.
And then at my school, we had a special program where kids from all over kind of the county would come. So we had people from St. Pete that should have been in like St. Pete High or whatever.
Right.
We had people from all over. and a lot of those St. Pete punk kids came
infiltrated
to Largo, yeah. You know, so we had an inn and we had, friends that we could go stay with or go hang out with or whatever down in St. Pete. So really it was just the proximity. You kind of had to, there was a few different clubs there that if you just showed up, there was something going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you would learn about, okay, so this person's having a house show at this place. You wouldn't know about it unless you were, you know, close to.
Word of mouth was really.
Exactly. And even some real small clubs and stuff started opening up. I remember seeing shows at this place, and I believe the memory is a little fuzzy, but I believe it was above like a tire shop, and they had turned this top floor of this like attic type space. I remember the ceiling was, it had to be like 6'5" tall. You know, it was yeah. low. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was called Song X, and they would have like if NoFX is a big name,
yeah,
they would have the people that were like 15 times smaller than, you know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
They would have the traveling, you know, punk bands that were just booking their own DIY gigs and all that stuff. Places like that really, really influenced me and really made me think like, yeah, people could look at this. This is amazing. Because the people that were making these things weren't some guy that had just a ton of money and was going to make a ton of money.
Right.
It was just like, hey, we found this cool space. Let's do something with it. So it was a show space, and it was a place where people could bring their zines and sell them. There, you could get local
zines
records.
Were such a vital thing too.
Yes, 100%. That was another thing. It seems crazy now, but that was another thing where you found out about bands because people took the time to review new artists, and you would send in your records to them. They would listen to it, and then they would write thoughtful, helpful reviews. You know
right.
what I mean? So, like, you could literally read these reviews and be like, okay, I think I'm pretty sure I know exactly what this is. I want to hear it. So I'm going to send in my $4 or $5 or whatever
yep.
in cash wrapped in aluminum foil to this sketchy distro.
Yep.
And then 6 to 8 weeks later, you get our new record in the mail. And,
oh,
you know,
man.
It's amazing. But
that was amazing.
It definitely is. I always say, yeah, it's so amazing and whatever, but for people now, you wouldn't really want to trade what we can do now for the world. I mean, it was very cool back then.
Yeah.
But it was definitely looking back on it with like rose-colored glasses. Would I rather wait 8 weeks for a record, or would I rather like find out about someone's band right now and listen to it on my
yeah.
way home? I would rather listen to it on my way home. It was fun. But it was also, I think, nostalgia for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, no one's in a race to pedal their car with their feet anymore.
Exactly.
So I guess
exactly.
we'll leave them all behind.
It was fun. It was a good time. And it was definitely, you know, different. But for those that haven't experienced waiting for something in the mail, it's
yeah, the discovery of the underground was kind of weird. The discovery process and the way things landed in your lap, it was definitely different. I mean, you still discover music now and go out on your music crawls, but it was definitely different
for sure.
then. Okay, so take me to the point where you got one green sleeve, things are feeling really good. What does the next discovery show you?
Basically, after that point, I got real into thrifting, going to all the local thrift stores and just digging through old dead people stuff. Did that for a long time.
And were you upcycling that stuff or just literally recycling it?
A lot of times I was changing it, fixing it, keeping it together, you know.
Gotcha.
Some of the older like jackets and stuff. You know, they would have a tear in them, or they were getting old and they were worn out. You know, this is stuff I was getting from like, you know, the 50s and stuff, some
mm-hmm.
of these pieces. So, that old cotton thread starts to wear over time. So yeah, just, you know, maintaining stuff more than anything. I think really the upcycling, part of it, came fairly recently. Of course, I made my own vests and jackets and stuff like that.
And painted them as well, right?
Back in the day, I just started doing a lot of the painting and bigger studded pieces and stuff now, recently, just because it's getting harder and harder to find, you know, even just materials or go in person to try to get studs from a place. It's not happening. You know what I mean? Like, there's not the same, since we do have the internet and you can buy everything online.
Right.
Local in-person stores aren't carrying stuff like they used to. I don't see the like punk stores like there used to be.
Yeah, I was gonna say. See, I'm a tad bit foreign to that portion of the show. How was that before? You just went places and bought.
Yeah. So back in the day, I mean, it wasn't like there was tons of places that you could go.
Yeah,
they
right.
were definitely precious.
Yeah.
But you could find places that had patches and shirts, and they probably had bags of studs, and they probably had, you know, they probably had a bunch of stuff like that. But I don't see that stuff a lot anymore. There used to be a place in Clearwater, and it's like one of my huge inspirations. It was called Crash and Burn, and it was a punk store. Like, you walked in, and one wall was all just boots.
Nice.
Doc Martens, grinders, all the, you know.
Staples.
Yep. She had cases full of patches and studs and braces and you could buy a flight jacket there. You could buy a leather jacket there. You could buy pants. You could buy whatever, bondage pants, everything. She was a older little German lady that had a son, I think, that is who really got her started doing this.
And it didn't seem so counterculture to them.
Right. Yeah. So he, I think he said, yeah, I think we should start the store. He was a bit older. He had a band. And then he moved to Atlanta, and she kept the store going here for quite a while. But even that dried up, I think real early 2000s, maybe late 90s or something like that.
Yeah, didn't even wait for the tidal wave of true internet.
Yeah, they had the Atlanta store. I know they went on for a while, but yeah, it just, you know, got to be too hard to have a brick and mortar, and I think it was her age too.
Yeah,
you know, so. But yeah, that's one of the things that whenever I'm thinking of what should I do next or what should I always just think, well, what could I have bought there?
Yeah,
and
right.
then it's like, okay, then now I know what my next step is. I need to do this, or I need to have this, or, you know, whatever.
So that brings up an interesting question. What are some of the challenges that you face for selling your wares when not only locally do you have, like, a fractured community to try to sell to,
mm-hmm.
because they've lost things like the store we can all go to, and because you've got things like the internet to compete with, where everybody's doing their upcycled things and you need to stand out in your own way. So what are some of the challenges you face and ways you stand out and get your things to people?
I think I try not to see anyone else as competition.
Right.
I try to, if anything, draw inspiration from other people. Like, wow, that's amazing. Look at this thing that they've made. You know, I need to get to work on that idea that I had as well, you know. A lot of times when people find my stuff, that's all it takes. It's definitely one of the, I don't have to sell to them. I don't have to like advertise to them. It's just put the stuff out there in the world. And when people find it, they know it's for them or it's not, you know?
Right.
So I do a lot of local markets, Central Florida, And that's been huge, huge, huge. I go about every weekend now. I've got something lined up and set up there and put my stuff out there. And I'm always surprised that more and more punks show up. And it's, you know, you got guys that are, you know, in their 50s and 60s.
Right.
You got kids that are 16, 17 years old. And they're all coming there and, like, you know, all looking and buying and, oh, I'm going to start a new jacket now. Look, I found a bunch of these patches. I'm going to start a new vest. And, you know, it'll be the little kid like, yeah, I've got a vest going and I just needed to get some studs. And, you know, so in that way, it's great because I can go to all these different communities. I'm not in just one spot where, you know, if I had a shop, say, just in St. Pete, it's great. I'm servicing St. Pete, Tampa, maybe, you know, the surrounding areas. But
right.
These people on the other coasts, there's nothing out there for them. So when I show up to these events out there, literally the first time I showed up to, I was out in Port St. Lucie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the first punk rock flea markets that they had out there. Literally had people coming up and saying, thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. And I'm like, I'm just slinging my trash.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I'm just slinging my shit, you know. But you start talking to them, and they're like, there's nothing out here.
Right.
We get some bands occasionally, but there's nothing like – there hasn't been anything like this. So it's amazing that you're here. It's awesome that you're here. So
do you find that these are people who generally just aren't perusing the internet to find things like you're selling, and it is just that same old value of being face-to-face? They see you. They see your items, and then that's when we turn out to be shopping for it, for want of a better way of putting it?
Yeah. I mean, so apparently talking to these people they're not really seeing the same stuff that I'm doing.
Gotcha.
Especially at any of these other punk rock flea market type events or whatever, there might be someone else with a couple little patches here and there.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a person or two that is. That's doing maybe upcycled clothing. But really, the stuff that I'm making, there's not a whole lot of people doing it. And some of that could be because a lot of the stuff has always been you do it yourself.
Right.
DIY.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I see a need out there. People don't have as much time to do the stuff themselves anymore. I had a guy that came up and he said, originally I saw that you had this jacket. And it was, I don't even know what it was, $150 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole back of it's covered in studs. He's like, I went home and he said, and I started to stud my jacket, and he said, I got like 3 hours in and I had like a section that was like 3x3, and he's like, fuck this is terrible, you know, this is, and I said, yeah, you know, he's like, do you have a machine that does this? I'm like, no, I do it all by hand. Yeah, it's all by hand, you know, so as far as like, you know, competing with anything that's out there, there's a few people that are doing custom jackets and custom, but not as many as you would think. So it's not really too much of a competition, really.
But one of the things you do to stand out, I guess, could be you can play into that OCD and do these more solid stud patterns. Talk to me a little bit about how you do that and get it so uniform and what this labor of love actually is. People see the end product, and like this guy found out, they have no idea what went into it.
Yeah, 100%. I got into graphic design. It got into using Illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
And Illustrator allows you to set up complicated patterns exactly how you want them.
Mm.
So what I did is I set up the exact size of a stud, set up how far away I wanted each stud, and now I'm able to print out huge patterns.
There you go.
And I put it onto the jacket, and then I have a leather punch that I go and I punch holes for each of the studs, and then after that it's just plugging in the studs and bending the tabs. So it took something like coming up with this, because I've done it traditionally by putting them each into their own spot, but it would be days and days of labor.
Plus, it's so hard to get them accurate, yeah?
Exactly. And that's great too.
Right.
You know, the however you want to do it, I'm all for, like I said, I'm not competing with anyone.
No.
You know, however you want to do it, if you like it to look a certain way, then that's you, you know.
That's kind of the beauty of it.
That is the beauty of it. You know, however you want to do it, whatever you want to do, I think all of them are great. Every jacket I've ever seen, I'm like, if you've truly put your heart into it, then it's great. It's amazing. But yeah, it got to the point where I was like, there has to be some way I can figure this out. So now I start making patterns.
So how long did you put yourself through it before the pattern came to be?
I did too many of these jackets. Probably 5 or 6 just recently to like resell, and then like who knows how many before that for myself or for friends or whatever.
Right.
Where I was just hand placing the studs. And it like I said, it would just, you know, if I were charging by the hour to do it.
Yeah.
So I had to come up with something to kind of streamline that process, because I don't want to charge $500 for a jacket. I don't want to charge, $500 for a vest. Who can afford it?
No one that's can a totally it. Different animal.
No one can afford. There's a certain strata of people that could afford it, but I'm selling to 16 to whatever 40 year olds. Yeah. None of us have a ton of extra money to spend on stuff like this. So, so now I offer that on my website. I have the where you can download and print the patterns yourself, and I have a tutorial on the tools that I use. And
very
all that
cool.
Stuff. Because again, I'm not competing with anyone, and I struggled, so you can be
not
the beneficiary.
Yet,
you
right.
know, because I've benefited from knowledge from that's been passed down from older. Using dental floss back in the day.
Yes,
using dental
floss
to sew on patches, and they would hold forever.
I was going to say that's an old school one. People don't do much anymore, but they would hold forever.
Hold forever. And then you could also get like the mint or the cinnamon dental, and have like a green thread or some red thread.
Yep.
And your stinky old vest would smell like mint for a little bit. So.
Oh man, I remember that. the DK armbands. With
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's kind of an interesting thing. How do you kind of work the angle of selling something that can be so, or not even selling, just creating it in the first place? Something that can be so highly personalized, either for the person that's making it or for the person that buys it. Where do you kind of stop customizing it so you don't have only one human out of 9 billion to sell it to?
Yeah. So what I was doing initially was bringing these semi-completed to more completed vests to these events and using them kind of as a proof of concept or whatever, as like, hey, look at what I can do. If you want something custom, let me know.
Mm.
When I started doing that, though, people were like, how much for that, though?
Ah.
So then it became like, okay, let's just work on a theme. Motorhead. Let's just do a Motorhead vest. I make my own patches. So I'm able to make whatever I want. So we did a big Motorhead back patch, did a couple of front patches, studded it, went to an event, had a guy walk up and say, hey, let me call my buddy real quick. and get him to come down here because he's going to want that vest. And then I had someone 5 minutes after that, and he's like, hey, I saw that vest on Instagram. Do you still have it? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, I've been saving up for it. So here's the money. And then the other guy that got called was like, hey, do you still have that? You know,
yeah.
No, it's gone, whatever. So it's a little tougher to, it seems, to sell people on completely custom stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason. A lot of people get nervous, or it's that thing where you, when you have too many choices, you just do nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I like to do custom work for people. I had a I don't know what you would, not an amateur, but he's in, like, say the minor leagues of wrestling.
Yeah, yeah.
Semi-pro.
Yeah. Yeah.
Contact me. He's a wrestler.
Yeah.
And wanted some gear to wear out to the ring. And he's like, listen, I got two ideas for a back patch. But is there any way we could make it so I could take one off and put a different one on? One's more family friendly than the other.
Ah.
I said, yeah, yeah. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but yeah,
yeah,
we could,
sure,
do,
we
that.
Can do that.
Yes. It's one of those things where, like, I've heard actors talk about it. It's like, you always say yes. Can you ride a horse? Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And then you figure out how to ride a horse, you know?
Eventually, so. I can. Yeah. Yes, soon.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I loved that project. It was amazing. He was super happy with it. I was, you know, thrilled with, you know, figuring it out. But, you know, that was a totally custom thing that he definitely had an idea.
Right.
Other people, they have a couple little basic ideas, and they say, do whatever, you know, do whatever you want to do. Those are great too.
So people can just either bring you a garment, or you have a garment and they have an idea. You do any combination.
Anything.
To make the idea a thing.
Yeah, especially right now, any job would do it. I have a lot of stuff that I try to keep in stock. So I go to thrift stores every week, and I snap up not anything like name brand or whatever. I'm just looking for pieces, you know, denim jackets, denim whatever, pants, shorts, whatever, skirts. Stuff like that. And a lot of the people that are doing thrift flips and stuff, they're looking for labels.
Right.
Because, you know, that's typically what sells.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm fine with that. That's not, I was with, actually my mom, and we were at a thrift store, and, she said, oh, did you see that guy over there? I said, no. She said, when we walked in, he looked at you and he was like, that's my competition. And he couldn't be further from the truth. I'm picking up the stuff that no one else is. I'm picking up the bulk stuff.
Right.
I don't care about what the label is. As long as the material seems like I can work with it and it'll hold up. I want the junk. I want the trash that's going to end up in the landfill. I want that stuff. That way I can take it and turn it into something that someone will hold on to for a long time, maybe pass on, or maybe it'll hopefully get circulated around until there's just nothing left of it.
Yeah, that is one of the cool things about personalized clothing like that.
That's what I'm trying to do. So, I'm not looking for any kind of labels or anything. I want to make something out of stuff that everyone else is passing by, you know, so... and doing that, has worked out really well.
So it's not only just the DIY ethos, but it is also kind of making the wheel go around better as well.
Yeah. Trying to keep that stuff out of the trash. You know, there is, when you go to these thrift stores, there is miles of clothing.
Yeah.
That are there. I found the same pair of pants. So I found this pair of terrible leopard pants.
Mm-hmm.
They were, I don't know where they were from, but I saw them. I've seen them like 5 or 6 different thrift stores and a couple pairs at each.
And lots of leopard regret.
And it's because they're shaped so poorly. They did such a, like the material's great. The pattern looks great. But they're shaped, they're not for a human. They're just shaped so poorly. And it got to the point where I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with them, but I'm going to start buying these and I'll figure out how to, you know, if nothing else, I'll break them down and I'll use the fabric for patches or whatever.
Right.
But I started buying them up and I started, they worked out. I was able to turn them from pants into these leopard skirts.
Nice.
And they sell like hotcakes. They're amazing. They look perfect as a skirt, terrible as pants. So it's that type of thing. It's, I'm trying to take stuff that ultimately would be tossed aside and thrown away and turn it into something that, you know, people find value in again. People already have find value in that, like, vintage whatever, Nike shirt or whatever it is. Or,
right.
You know, Carhartt's huge right now. They already find That's value funny. In that. You know what I mean? I want the junk. Give me the trash, and I'll turn it into something cool.
What do you think attributes to something like Carhartt now being in fashion? What's the ebb and flow of this sort of thing? Because it has so many like staple elements, but then certain things get cool.
I think workwear in general has been cool forever.
Yeah, like the Dickies type.
Dickies. Was huge, yeah. You know, even back in our day,
yeah,
you know,
for sure,
you know.
Oh, I remember customizing just straight painter's clothes.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's that thing where it's like you take something that you usually see X person wearing and now you're wearing it. So it changes, it changes its meaning, kind of. I don't know. All I know is workwear has been cool forever, you know.
And now it's just Carhartt turn.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just that particular brand's turn right now, okay. You know. Because like I said, before that, it was Dickies and Red Cap, Levi's. Think about Levi's. Levi's were, you know, coal miners.
Right.
You know, would put them on. That's why they find ancient pairs of Levi's down in these coal mines and stuff.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, 100%.
Really?
So, yep. So the some of the oldest pairs of Levi's that are around, like from when they were originally made, miners would put them on over their regular street clothes or their other work clothes and take them off down in the mines and leave them down there. So now people are going into some of these old shut down mines and finding these old pairs of Levi's that are 100 years old or more.
That's wild.
Yep. So think about Levi's started off as like working man's clothes. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like the hardest workers or people, you know, cowboys and stuff wearing them. And then then they got to, you know, the 501 came out and everyone lost their minds. You know, James Dean and stuff was wearing these and they became popular, super popular. Everyone was wearing them. But yeah, that's what they originally were. They were coal miner fans.
God, that's crazy.
Yep.
And to think that, you know, that stuff lasts. And that's one of the nice things, or I should say one of the added bonuses to upcycling things like this that aren't going anywhere.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah. So the denim that's around now is getting thinner and thinner, the newer stuff. So when I'm able to find some of the older Levi's jackets or even there's off-brand denim
right.
stuff that's older, it's just so much nicer to work with and it's going to hold up forever. You know, this is going to be stuff that for better or for worse, will be around for quite some time, you know. So I like working with that older stuff. It's great.
How much of your consciousness to keep this stuff out of landfills played into you choosing to do this when you could have done, you could have been painting cars or doing any number of things? You clearly have a skill set to fold tab A into slot B and make something new. How did this one get to be where you wound up?
Honestly, I don't know. I've thought about it many a time. I don't know exactly. It was just something that kept building on itself. I guess basically when I first started Gluehead, what I was doing was just printing patches. Screen printing patches, making buttons, shirts, obviously.
And how long ago was this?
I guess 5 or 6 years ago now. Started screen printing. I wanted to screen print since I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. I bought a screen printing setup, one of those mail order deals. Put it together and just didn't have enough of the stuff to make it legit. Basically, I was trying to cure prints. Basically, for people that don't know, screen print ink has to get to a certain temperature or it never hardens.
Right.
It always stays runny and it'll smear on everything. So unless you have the right equipment to get it to that stage, it's just a nightmare. So I was trying to use a heat gun to set all this stuff, and it wasn't happening.
Yeah.
So at that point, I knew enough was enough. There's no way I was going to be able to make it work. I didn't have the space to, even if I wanted to buy more equipment, to do it correctly. So I put it aside for many years, and then it got to a point where I was looking for a new hobby, basically. I was a serial hobby jumper.
Yeah.
I've been into everything. Motorcycles. I had motorcycles. Cars. I've had cars. All the way to, like, RC stuff and just all kinds of photography and anything, any major hobby you can think of.
I kind of got that. You know? That's what I'm wondering. How you got here. I kind of sniffed that one.
This was a hobby into my wife saying, hey, you could sell this stuff, you know? You should sell this stuff. Why don't you sell this stuff? I said, okay, let's try it.
So you start with the screen printing and the buttons.
Yep. Started selling on Etsy. Started getting a little Instagram thing together. And then from there, people were noticing what I was doing. I had a couple people say, hey, you want to come bring your stuff here? You want to come vend at this market? And I said, yeah, we can do that. Again,
I was going to say, was nothing. That another one of those scenarios?
Yeah, I had nothing. I was just scrambling to find a table, and what do I do about this? And how do I display the stuff? And you know, that's been a thing that we've kind of been building on for years and years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's basically where it started. It started with screen printing stuff, and I felt like I had that nailed. I had that portion of it figured out. So then it went to, I was looking again, I was screen printing for myself, in the beginning. And then I was looking for, does anyone still make, you know, bondage pants or anything? No, not really. There's like one or two companies, and their quality from what I've heard has gone way down. And so I started making a couple pairs for myself. And then people saw them, where'd you get those? And then I was like, well, you know what? Let's start making some stuff, you know, let's start making some vests. And I would always get compliments. Oh man, your vest is amazing. I could never do something like that. Oh man, that, you know, it's like, well, I don't think that just because you don't have the time to do it means that you shouldn't have it.
Right.
There's a lot of these hardliners that are like, you either do it yourself or it's capitalist for fashion shit. It's like, how granular do you get with that?
That's what I was just thinking.
You know, I make my own patches. Do you? You know what I mean? Or are you just sewing some shit onto a jacket?
Right.
Do you make your own jacket? Did you make your own denim? Did you grow your own cotton? Like, how granular do you want to get with DIY or dye?
I confess, I didn't make my own cereal.
You know, I don't understand that. Let me do the stuff that I'm good at. You go do the stuff that you're good at. And you take that money, give it to me, and I give you the thing. Right. You know what I mean? Like, I think I'm good at making these, you know, pieces of clothes.
And having fun.
And it's fun. So, yeah, why don't we do that? You know what I mean? That's what this whole thing is based off of.
Truth.
Everyone's good at something, or, you know, that's what we all should be working towards, is getting good at something, having fun with, you know, being good at something.
And ironically,
let's reward each other.
Yeah, I was going to say, ironically, that's kind of the beauty of the DIY community. If everybody can do something themselves, then imagine what we can do together.
100%. You know, and that's the thing is, so I've gotten a couple people, you know, as I'm getting bigger and getting more exposure, there's always those people that are
kind of poo-poo.
Of course. And that's, out of everything, that's been the toughest thing for me.
Interesting.
Is dealing with just rando criticism.
Yeah.
I hate it so much because I know it's stupid. And when I'm doing it, I know it's dumb to even respond to them. But it's like, you've got me wrong. I'm not doing – like, if you saw how little I actually make from this stuff, you wouldn't say that, oh, look at this guy. He's a sellout or whatever. But it's also – think about – that some of the people that I sell to are people that can't do this stuff themselves. They don't have dexterity in their fingers anymore. They don't have time to do it. They don't, you know, whatever.
It's not a for everybody project.
Not everyone can do this stuff. You know what I mean? There's physical limitations. There's time restraints. There's health things. There's that's the thing. To me, it doesn't matter why you want to buy it. It's fine. Buy it. You know what I mean? I'm not the punk rock police. I'm not here to call out posers. I don't.
Right. That's ironic in and of itself. Always has been.
You know, you get the people, oh, well, you're selling out to rich people. What rich people do you think are buying this stuff? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not.
Not to mention the fact that, amen, if you were, because it's funneling money back into this community.
Whatever. And I'm taking that money and I'm giving it to bands. I'm giving it to local shows. You know what I mean?
You can show up at the flea market with more wares. You can enhance 100%. Well, that's kind of the ethos of not being the biggest boat, but the tide bringing us all up. And the DIY and the punk community has always been fucking fantastic in that regard.
Yeah, 100%. I'm working with the people that we that are putting on these events. None of them are sponsored by, you know,
Red Bull or whatever.
You know, this is all just people getting together and putting on a show and selling some stuff or bringing junk that we've found that we think other weirdos like us are going to think is cool too, you know. And there's value to that. I think there's, you know, I think the people that are sifting through these piles of junk at thrift stores and saying, oh, you know what that is? That's valuable.
Right.
And I know who I can take this to, and they'll find value in it. I think, you know, so a lot of people have been really down on clothing flippers and stuff. People that are, you know, they're ruining it. They're taking clothes away from poor people.
But there's such a glut of inventory at these places, it's mind-numbing.
Absolutely. I think, if anything, Some people are doing other people a favor by just clearing out some of the trash and some of the you know, whatever.
For real.
So they can put more of the stuff out there on the racks. It's never ending. At this point, maybe it will dry up someday, but at this point, it's insane.
See, that's what I was just going to ask you, what you thought the future of this was, because I do have a dear friend in the Midwest who has turned thrifting into a brick and mortar store that does quite well. And he kind of specializes in 90s, you know, like sports stuff, old Jordan stuff, whatever, whatever. And there's just a huge community for it. And, you know, say what you will about, you know, being one of these flippers, but he's opened a business. He's putting food on his table. He's employing people now. Yep. Yep. You know what I mean? So do you see the future more things like that? Or less, or we're sort of at the high water mark of that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I've thought about it recently. How long can this trend of people playing 90s and 2000s dress up, how long can that be a thing before you know, these, you know, major corporations and say that's not cool. You need to be dressing like this or the next trend. I don't know. I know that there's always going to be people that that want to wear vintage. There's always been people that have been wearing vintage.
Right.
I had a friend just out of high school. She worked at a store in Ybor. That was vintage thrift. So she was into it since the high school, however, 20, 30 years. You know what I mean? Like, till today, that store is still booming. So there's always going to be people that are interested in the old stuff. But it is pretty wild to see how many kids are in the thrifts. I say kids, but they're, you know, probably 18, 19, 20 years old, but they're still kids to me. But it's wild to see how many of those people are in there now picking up stuff.
Do you think this is sort of a thing like a regurgitated scenario of the fact, like in the 90s, you saw people in like 70s garb? Do you think 100%. that this is just going to be that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I don't know. Personally, I don't get it. I don't see myself wearing the Bugs Bunny wearing the backwards pants, t-shirts and stuff. And I don't know how much longer that's going to be popular.
Right.
It'll probably switch to something else. Maybe it'll even go back further. Maybe people will want pieces from the 70s again and
60s. We can go all the way back to mod clothing.
Yeah, maybe. You know, maybe. There's always going to be people out there wanting vintage, I think. But the Wild West of it right now.
Yeah.
Where certain like band T-shirts are bringing $600-$700.
Oh, I got some good stories on that.
I don't know if that's sustainable, but yeah.
Yeah, that is the Wild West, especially if you're willing to sell them overseas.
Right. And it's going to come a time where there's going to be like weird knockoffs of that stuff. If there's money to be made with it, someone's going to find a way to make a modern version of an old shirt, because there's no good way of, okay, so they produced, 10,000 of these T-shirts. We have, 7,000 of them accounted for.
Right.
You don't know if it has the telltale signs of it looking old or vintage, then it probably is, and people are going to spend a bunch of money. I think that's what we're going to see next is vintage knockoffs.
Oh,
it's
going
to be – I think right now maybe it's too much work maybe to do it, or someone hasn't figured out how to do it yet, but it's coming, I think.
Well,
I think
that's one of the nice things about your stuff too, because you have to put in the hand hours or forget it.
There's... Yeah. The stuff that I'm making is – I'm not afraid – if anyone else wants to put it this way, if anyone else wants to do it and they want to copy what I'm doing,
the template's on your site.
Do it. Have fun. It's a labor of love for sure. If you start putting in the hours and you see actually how much I'm making off of this stuff, it's not much, but I don't need a whole lot to get by. So that's,
well, you know, that's what a passion play is. And thankfully there are still people that are willing to do it.
Yeah. If I didn't have to sell the stuff, I swear I wouldn't sell it. You know, I would just give the stuff away if I could, if I was able to afford to, you know, do this stuff and provide it for what I have into it or whatever, then that's 100% what I would do. But I got to support myself to keep it going, you know?
Yeah, and that's just the thing. You know what I mean? These industries do help people get to do their thing, and that's one of the things we're huge about here on the show, people being able to do their thing. Yeah. and the invaluable nature of that. So I wanted to ask you one more thing, and then we can get you out of here on something fun. When you mentioned, you know, rich people aren't buying these things, there is a tiny sect of rich people that want to look like punks, want to do all this and that. Do you ever find that people see your vests or any of your clothing that you've made and they think that you bought it that way, that you didn't make it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Where'd you get that? Is there a place local that has that, or, you know, no,
right.
No, this is stuff that I've made, or, you know,
because if you told somebody that was a designer vest that you paid $1,500 for, there's a huge group of people that wouldn't bat an eye at that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And there's probably, that's the other thing too, is there's probably people out there that would change the way they saw it.
Right.
So, oh, you made that yourself too. Oh, I paid, you know, $2,500 for this thing. This is obviously so-and-so designer.
Yeah, right.
Then they would instant like, oh, look at the craftsmanship. Oh, look how great it is, you know, versus,
yes,
you know, so, yeah, I occasionally have people that, you know, you can tell they've got a bit of money. You can tell that they have a good job. But,
and it seems like you bought that, and that might be expensive
garment.
Where'd
you get that from? Yeah. But it's cool. Whatever.
Here's
my website. You want to buy one? It's fine. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't really have a problem. If you're brave enough to wear it, wear it. You know what I mean? If that's what you want to look like, that's fine. I don't know how that... They're not showing up to any of the shows and causing a problem.
Yeah, right. Yeah, of course.
So I don't know if people are, you know, there was that time period where you had a ton of artists. I think there was pictures of who was it? Chris Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the you know, bigger pop stars or whatever,
mm-hmm,
that were going to these shops in New York and buying these old, like, crust punk jackets and old...
The old, you know, Osrod and OGs.
Yeah, stuff like that. And wearing it around and having no idea some of the stuff that was even on there. You know,
right,
what I mean? I remember there was someone... one of the people's jackets, there was like a super questionable... Maybe they're a little neo-Nazi-ish band or whatever on... one of these pop stars, and they had no idea that they're wearing this stuff around. And like, it's like, that's a little bit suspect. You know what I mean? Like, you would definitely get called on that if you went to a show, you know what I mean? Like, just so happens.
You'd have to know you were wearing it.
Exactly. You would definitely be called on it and said, you know, what's your deal? You know what I mean? Like,
that's when the policing of the community does happen a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's the other thing is, okay, I feel like it's not gatekeeping to kick out Nazis.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
Like, they just ruin scenes. We don't need them around. When it comes to that sort of gatekeeping, I'm 100% for it.
Yeah, that's standard keeping.
Yes, exactly.
I can go along with that one.
100%.
So let me get you out of here on something fun.
Yeah.
If you could design, modify, make, create, whatever adjective you want to tag for it, one garment to put on one person, what would it be and who would they be?
I'd like to make a vest for, who would I make? I don't know. I would like to work with Lux Interior from The Cramps. That's who I would want to work with. Yeah, he always had. So The Cramps were like one of the first early like psychobilly bands.
Yep.
And he always had. He definitely was a huge inspiration for me. Kind of like dress however you want. You know what I mean? So. He would go to like weird sex shops and stuff and wear like vinyl pants and stuff or like rubber stuff
or
women's clothes but he always made it look real cool. Like not, it wasn't super obvious that the stuff was like,
The trick.
You know, it wasn't like, he wasn't doing it in a glam way. He was just, it just looked like, that looks like him. That looks like his style. That looks like what he wanted to wear that day. You know what I mean? He definitely, while he was a, flawed person, I think his sense of style was very, very cool. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Good answer.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you coming down. I had a blast hearing from you. I learned a lot about your world, and I can't thank you enough, man.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Yep.